88% of the workweek is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. And now I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm continuing to report from Delphi, Indiana, spending long nights in line and sitting in court each day to bring you detailed reports from the Richard Allen trial. Allen is charged with murdering best friends, 13-year-old Abigail Williams and 14-year-old Liberty German in February of 2017. And the judge has actually decided to not only not televise this trial, but to also not even share audio. Thus, I am here to be the eyes and ears of the courtroom. These episodes are nightly live streams that I record on YouTube shortly after court ends each day. And if you notice these episodes are a bit more choppy than our other episodes, please understand why. We are working around the clock to bring you the very latest on the trial with a quick turnaround. And if you would like to catch the full unedited live stream, you can always head over to Hidden True Crime on YouTube. Hello, Hidden Gems. I have my phone ready just in case we have wireless problems today. We got a hotspot. It wasn't ideal. We're back. I have a new computer, all this stuff. So if there's something happens with this live and I need to switch over, I have my phone ready. We'll just do that. Delphi, you know, every place has its problems and that's our problem here. It was an interesting day of defense today. Forgive me for being a little bit late. I was tired. And so I crashed for a bit. I ate and here we are. So thanks for being with me. And again, for our listeners in the United States, it's a big day. Everybody's watching election results. And so trust me, I'm honored that anybody is here with me tonight. And I think it's wonderful too, because we need to talk about what happened in court. And, you know, it was interesting because it is election day. The court offices were closed. You know, nobody could go visit the Carroll County Courthouse for anything except for the Richard Allen trial. The day started, by the way, with me not almost getting into court. And it was just like another reminder, even though I had a number in line, I was safe to get in. I had gone from the steps to the courthouse to right in front of the courtroom. You know, we just keep getting transferred on the third floor. We just go from one place to another. All was well. I had to run to the restroom. And when I came back, they were like, you got to go to the back of the line. And that never happened before. But my point being, it just reminded me again that being in that courtroom is a privilege a privilege every day. And I'm grateful for the bailiff that let me in and that there was some room. So yeah. You know, every day, I guess the point is every day we wonder, am I going to be able to get in? You never, ever totally know. So, all right. So we had, I don't even have my notes right here. Let me get them all. Another day of defense, of course, another day of defense. It's Tuesday. Both families, they're very full, very, very full courtroom. Another reason I was glad I got in. The Kathy Allen was there. She was back. And then Richard Allen's mom and dad, who, you know, and his sister. So all four of his family members, not his daughter. But his daughter did, after she testified yesterday, she stayed the rest of her time in court. She did stay there, Brittany, but she was not there today. Other family members were. And then on the in the prosecution side, you had Abby's mother, Abby's grandparents, you had the Patties that were there, and you had Carrie as well, Libby's mother and her daughters, Libby's sisters. everybody has support here in the courtroom. Prosecution, they started with prosecution filed a motion in limine for limiting instruction for defense witness. Diener brought it up. And before court, Richard Allen walked in and he actually looked pleasantly surprised to see all four family members. He said, "Oh, wow," and smiled, or at least it looked like he mouthed the words, "Oh, wow," and looked happy. The state cites Indiana Rule 704B. They don't want the witness to give opinions on guilt, innocence, truth, falsity, the defense witnesses, or any of those falsity of statements or legal conclusions or intent. The prosecution wants Judge Gold to admonish witness of these rules. And the defense says no discovery has been done by the state. And the defense actually feels like the prosecution is trying to handcuff them so that they can't ask their witnesses certain things. And Rosie reminds everyone that he will ask the witnesses before testifying. And make sure to make this clear. And Judge Gold tells the defense that she does trust the defense not to go on that. Like they don't, she won't handcuff them. But if it doesn't work out, then she's going to send the jury out and have this conversation once again with the defense and prosecution, and it will be much harsher. So she's saying, "Look, I trust you. Move forward. I know that you won't have your defense witnesses talk about this stuff, but if just let's just do this right." So they have a conversation and then the jury walks in. And once the jury walks in, they have the defense calls their first witness, and that is Betsy Blair. And Betsy Blair has been on the stand before. She was a witness for the prosecution. And just to remind everyone who Betsy Blair is, Betsy Blair is somebody that was a witness at the trail who says that she believes that she saw Bridge Guy. And she was walking around the track multiple times. She did two loops. She left at one moment to use the restroom, came back, and she had all the timestamps and everything because of her health fitness or where she went or a fitness app. And she saw a man on the trail on the first platform of the bridge. So that's Betsy, just to refresh your memory. And now she is back for the defense as a defense witness. So her name is Elizabeth, actually. She goes by Betsy, and Baldwin is doing the questioning. And Baldwin says, "So how many questions did the prosecution ask you when you were on the stand about a car you saw?" And she says, "They did not ask me." And they say, "Well, how many times and what time did you go to the trail again on this February 13th, 2017 day?" And Betsy says, "Well, I went two times. I first walked around and then I left. And then I came back around 1:45 PM she left around 1:45 PM and then she came back around 2:15, give or take a few minutes." "Well, how many cars were by the Mears lot?" She said one. And then, "Which route did you take to leave?" And she said, "Well, I turned left on 300 North. I passed a business on the north side and a house on the left side on the corner where you turn. And on the corner where you turn, there is an empty government building. And then you pass Anderson's Grain." And then they ask her, "When you passed the CPS lot, what did you see?" And she says, "I saw one vehicle." "And why did you notice this vehicle?" And she says that she noticed it because it was parked weird. "It was parked with the front towards the county road." In other words, it was backed into this, you know, abandoned CPS building. She didn't say abandoned at this moment. She just said the old government building, the CPS building. "And what else did you notice about this car?" She said she noticed the overall shape. It looked like it had sharp angles. And they asked, "Did it remind you of any vehicles that you know?" And she said, "Well, yeah, after I thought about it later, it reminded me of my dad's 65 Comet." And then she said, so she sees this car that's parked in and she says, "Did it remind you of another vehicle that you know? Like, how did you recognize this?" And she said, "Yeah, after I thought about it, it later reminded me of my dad's 65 Comet." "And what color was it?" they ask. She says, "It wasn't bright. I know that it was not a bright color. It was not red. It was not yellow." "Well, did you say that it wasn't black?" And she says, I don't know if I said it wasn't black." They gave her then, the defense then gave her a statement that she made on April 2nd in 2019. So this is actually 2 years after the murders. And they show her page 7, line 25, and it states that in 2019, when speaking to investigators, I said it was a nondescript in color. And she's actually reading at this moment the paper in front of her that they handed her to refresh her memory. And so at this moment, the state objects because Betsy's actually reading a piece of paper. So they're supposed to take, you know, the paper away. So did it look in 2019, she then answers again, I said that it could not have been black. And then they ask a question, did it look like a hatchback? She said, I didn't see the back. I only saw the side. And did you draw the car that you saw for law enforcement or a sketch of the car? And she says, yes, she did. And there is a pic admitted into evidence and the paper is given to the jury. And then there is a cross-exam by the prosecution with Diener. And she says, Betsy, you also talked to police in February of 2017, correct? And she said, yes. So again, February 2017, of course, is the month of the murders of Abby and Libby. And she asked, so do you remember that on February 17th, 2017, that you said you noticed it was odd that you saw an odd car that was parked? And she said, yes, I remember. And did I contact you and say that someone else also saw an older car? And she said, yes. The objection is that the prosecution is testifying, it's overruled. And then Baldwin says, okay, well, can I put the prosecutor on the stand then for her testimony? It was quite the abrupt, like, okay, well, if you're going to overrule this, let's just put the prosecutor on the stand. So it was kind of a moment for Baldwin. And then they continue on with Cross. And she says, do you feel certain that it was the old CPS building? She says, yes. And what was your vision like in 2017? She said that she wore contact lenses, but when she wore them, she could see. And then now we have the jury questions. I actually thought the jury questions were interesting because this is a jury that knows details that I don't even know. I'm like, how do you guys know that? Like, you guys are studying. But these were kind of like, they didn't realize this. So the question from a jury is it possible that the car parked at the CPS lot was a person working there? And she explained that, no, it was a building that was abandoned. And I thought that that was kind of known, but maybe they didn't make that clear in trial. And then the next question was, did anyone check to see if it belonged to an employee? And her answer was, I don't know. But again, there were no employees in this building. Again, kind of that's, I'm like trying to go back in court now. I'm wondering, like, did they not make that clear? Because clearly the two jury questions didn't fully understand that this was an abandoned building, that nobody was working there. And then we have the next witness. The next witness is Dr. Stuart Grossian. I believe that's how you spell it. He was an interesting looking, distinguished older man. He had this, I don't know how to explain this, very distinguished look to him and a very big nose that even helped him just like look more distinguished to me. Short hair, older gentleman. He introduces himself as a psychiatrist. And I thought, there you go. And he did his undergrad at Harvard. He also went to Harvard Medical School and He's actually faculty at Harvard Medical School for 25 years. He still gives lectures and seminars there. He is board certified. He is in good standing and he's been a doctor for a very long time because he completed his residency in 1977. So he said a long time. That was his answer. And he specializes in memory of traumatic events and false memories, which that was really intriguing. I want to read some of his thoughts on false memories now. He says that his testimony today is regarding solitary confinement. And he also has done a lot of studies on solitary confinement. He has worked on both sides of the aisle for the defense and the prosecution, and he has testified in court before. He worked on one case hand in hand with the FBI about a terrorist that was cooperating, and then he stopped, and then he conducted large studies, evaluated several hundred people that had been in solitary. And they asked him what he does on a daily basis. He has a practice outside of his home, Sometimes he goes into the hospital. He gets called about lawsuits, helping with those. He does oftentimes he does things pro bono. He gets called for forensic work and to give lectures at Harvard. And they ask him, what did I ask when I called you? And then the doctor says, hold on, that Mr. Allen made potentially incriminating statements while in solitary. And what did I give you? And he said that this is what I read about it, that I read Dr. Westcott's reports, records, videos. And the question, did you also listen to audio and phone calls? And he's like, oh yeah, definitely. Thank you for reminding me. He said, he had transcripts of interrogations, of interviews, and all of the info from October 2022 through March of 2024. Was there anything that stood out to you? They ask him. He said, no doubt that Mr. Allen, then there's an objection and a sidebar. They went back to how Rosie reached out. He said, what did I say to you? And Rosie explained to him that Mr. Allen had made some statements and his question, and he had questions about his mental state during those statements. And he reviewed Dr. Westcott's report, video of the notes, et cetera, a lot of the reports, audio transcripts, and also as well as the inmates that had been S companions from November 22 to April or June 23. And then he was transferred and he received reports after that as well. And then the prosecution approaches. And the question is, let's talk solitary confinement. Explain in general terms what solitary confinement means. And he says, well, solitary confinement means that you're in a small cell with minimal opportunities for sensory stimulation or social interaction. It is lonely. It is toxic. It is helpless. The people in solitary confinement can be confused, disoriented, and they can become psychotic. It's lonely. This is important though. Okay, so back, focus now. He says, let's talk solitary confinement. He explains what it is, and then he explains it's lonely, toxic, helpless, and they can be confused, disoriented, and they can become psychotic. The prosecution objects at this moment. Then the prosecution interrupts completely and starts questioning. They're like, we've got to set some foundation here. So the prosecution jumps in and they're like, okay, look, what is solitary confinement to you, doctor? And he says, well, it means a small, and do you know the situation that, Richard Allen was in? Let's talk if you even know the situation that Richard Allen was in. And they say, well, we know that he knows that it was a small cell, barren. There was a mattress on the floor. There were mouse droppings. That's the first I've heard of those, that he never visited. But I have seen plenty, he explains, of solitary confinement. The doctors then ask, but you've never seen his one man cell, correct? And he's like, well, I've seen, videos and I've seen circumstances from Dr. Walla. And they're like, but do you understand the difference between a one man cell and, and what solitary confinement, like the difference between these two things for safety reasons? And it almost at this moment feels like a cross exam, but because the prosecution keeps going, but it's not cross exam yet. It's just like setting foundation. And then that she's sort of questioned and the prosecution explains, and this is Diener. She says, well, look, I'm just wondering if the sources here are reliable. Like, does she really know the circumstance or does he really know the circumstances that Richard Allen was in? And they sort of set the stage there and they continue on. And Diener asks who regulates this? And unfortunately, who regulates what solitary confinement is? Unfortunately, it's not totally regulated. And then Diener is going to object and her objection is sustained. And then he explains that symptoms one might suffer once again in solitary confinement in most severe cases are delirium, confusion, memories of events. And the most frightening is no memory at all during that time, having absolutely no memory. That that smearing feces is something that could be common, or acting out sexually. That is as bad as it gets. So smearing feces and acting out sexually as bad as it gets, not knowing where they are. There's a very high rate of self-harm, 7 to 9%. And then they ask, what is delirium? And delirium is when a person doesn't have a idea of where they are. It's a super fog, everything close by, nothing makes sense. There's total bewilderment. Causes of delirium: inadequate external stimulation or stressors, and deprivation of external situations or medical conditions. So he explains again, I'm listening to phone calls. And so, did you see symptoms of delirium? They asked the doctor when it comes to Richard Allen. And by the way, we're back at now he is being questioned by the defense. I hope I made that clear. The prosecution had this moment. We're back to the defense questioning their own witness. And he said there was an objection. It was overruled. He said, yes, he saw things that were consistent with a delirious state. And it's an absolute inability to remember and being frightened. And he said, this is absolutely classic delirium. And he explains now what false memories are. And false memories are something that many people develop. And this is, there are many studies that have done to show false memories start as beliefs. So what they start with is many people will start a false memory with, I think I saw, or I think I did this. This was really interesting to me. I want to ask John about this. So if it's a false memory, it'll start with someone saying, I think this happened, or I think I may have, or I think I did this. And the memories develop over time, almost like a game of telephone. When it comes to, hold on one second, but when it comes to not false memories, so after they explain false memories, they're like, yeah, false memories start as a thought and then they become a memory. They shift over time when a person starts thinking, I think. And then we get to prosecution and then it's cross-exam. And Diener asks, what is it? I just realized, is my mic close enough? Oh, what someone asked, what does it mean by the telephone game? So you know the gaming you played when you were little? They didn't explain this. This is what I think he meant by the telephone game. So let me be clear. All he said is it's like the telephone game. What I think he meant by that is that when you whisper to someone, I think I might have done this, and or, you know, when you're whispering to someone something and they whisper something to someone else, and they whisper something to someone else, and then you hear something completely different than it originally started. You do that in your brain, I assume is what he means. Like you're like, I think I might have done that, and then it becomes more solidified and you create an entire false memory in your brain. When making savings decisions, I want to know where my money is going. Acorns allows me to have that clarity. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. If you've ever wanted to start an IRA, Acorns has got you covered to get a good start. Open an Acorns Later IRA now and get up to a 3% match on new contributions. Who doesn't love extra retirement money? Something I love about Acorns is they allow you to see projected growth on their website. Simply go online, type in how much money you'd put in, and see the potential future balance of your account. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/hiddentruecrime. These days, things impacting my hormones feels like an endless list. And after talking to friends, I know that I'm not alone. It is so frustrating to figure out how to feel like myself again. And sometimes just when we think we're on top of it, perimenopause or menopause hits and it's like starting all over again. But Hormone Harmony is a formula I've been taking daily. It contains herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, the beauty about adaptogens, they help the body adapt to stress, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout our lives. Symptoms such as night sweats, poor sleep, racing thoughts, low mood. In the 30,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony, there's a repetitive thing women keep saying: they feel like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's happymammoth.com. Use code HiddenTrueCrime for 15% off today. Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. It is November and Christmas is right around the corner, and it is time to get ahead of your shopping. That's where Uncommon Goods comes in. They are my one-stop shop to find the best gifts for everyone in my life. From root beer making kits to air forts for kids to inkless photo printers, Uncommon Goods has you covered. You will find the perfect individualized gift for everyone in your life that will make each person feel valued and cared for. Shopping at Uncommon Goods means you're supporting artists and small businesses along the way. And on top of that, with every purchase, they give $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice so you can feel good about spending your money this holiday season. Get 15% off your next gift. Go to uncommongoods.com/hiddentruecrime. That's uncommongoods.com/hiddentruecrime for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. So then the cross starts, and cross exam is, what did you provide your people and subjects that you reviewed that became a false memory? And he has a hard time. He's kind of confused because that's not really his study. He's like, oh, that's not really our study or what we did. Our study was that people who didn't have memory of traumatic events and then they remembered something and they later recanted the study. It showed that people started with a belief and a vague memory. He's like, this is what my study is. And so he's kind of like, that doesn't really make sense. So she tries to explain him. Okay. Sorry. I'm switching between two sets of notes too. I have some notes that I rewrote and then I just go to my original, like really legible ones. He's like, okay. So it's the prosecution explains that it's not our study. Real memories, it would be enormously vivid. So this is the difference between a real memory. A real memory is vivid. You have sights, you have sounds. That's how you can tell the difference between a real memory. Their study, though, is about people who had a traumatic event, created a memory, and blocked it out. But people who recovered real memories, vivid. So that's really important. They're talking about the recovery of old memories versus complete false memories. How do you tell the difference? And I've actually wondered this so much just in general. So I was like listening even beyond the Richard Allen case, like, or trial, like wondering, really interesting. So according to this doctor, if it's a false memory, it starts with, I think. If it's a recovered old memory that's like been blocked in your mind and all of a sudden you recover it, the sights, the sounds, the feelings, like it's very, very vivid. You remember everything and it doesn't start with, I think this happened or I think that happened. It would be enormously vivid. Those who create false memories, again, he reiterates this multiple times. It starts with, I think. So then the prosecution says, so would a real memory be insight and feelings and how they felt? Does that not lend itself to a true memory? And then again, he reiterates, well, I think we're not kind of on the same page. What you're asking is kind of different than what our study is. He says it once again. And so Diener tries it again, a different way. Are you aware of why people need to be kept in safekeeping? So she's sort of implying like, this is again, she's clearly trying to imply there's a difference between solitary confinement and safekeeping, which is what the prosecution claims Richard Allen was in, was safekeeping, while the defense is, of course, trying to claim, you know, solitary confinement. So she explains, are you aware of why people need to be kept in safekeeping? And his answer is yes. But I'm not really aware of prison protocol or management per se. He focuses on the reaction to prison, not really, you know, why people are put in certain places. In solitary confinement, she asks then, do you differentiate between a safekeeping for punishment for someone and keeping them in a one-man cell and the difference between that and solitary confinement? And he said, well, whatever the reason isn't really that's not really my job to differentiate between those two things. She said, but you acknowledge the difference between the two of them, do you not? And then Rosie jumps in with redirect and he questions, look, whatever the reason for between, you know, whether it's a safety reason or solitary confinement, what you do is you figure out how it impacts the brain. Is that right? And the doctor says, yes, whatever the reason, it affects the brain. That's what I study. So he clarifies, this is what he studies. And his job there today was to explain just how bad solitary confinement was and what he saw and what he observed of Richard Allen. So now we have the jury questions. So here are the jury questions. You ready for this? Do you believe psychotic behavior can go back to normal after solitary confinement? And the answer to that is yes. A next question. Do you believe that a normal person can be completely psychotic after 6 months in solitary confinement? And his answer is absolutely. I have seen it. So the new witness is Dr. Eric Warren. He is from Memphis, Tennessee, and he is the owner of business. He has his own business, SED Forensic Consultants. He also does crime scene reconstruction. He has an undergrad in molecular biology. He has a doctorate in biochemistry, hence his doctor, Dr. Eric Warren. And he worked for the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation as a forensic scientist. He does firearm and tool mark. He is a firearm and tool mark examiner, or certified one. Yeah, so now we know why he's here, right? He was also part of a violent crimes response team, and he worked with law enforcement. He has a background in academics that was all research-based. He was transferred to forensics, and he studies things that were external. So, okay, I remember. So at his time with the FBI, he did research-based stuff. Then he was transferred to forensics, and he did do some external things like bullets in a crime lab. With law enforcement, Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, not FBI. He's not FBI, forgive me. He is part of the American Federation of Firearms, and he served as a board, an active member. He testified for the state and defense. And they just continue on with more and more background. And then the first question that the defense asks him is there a critical community of your firearms identification? He says, yes, we defend our industry. And a lot of criticism comes from the President's Council of Science and Technology, or PCAST, and NAS, which is the National Academy of Science. These are groups that contract a number of people who review our data very critically. And the criticism, though, he explains, is actually helpful. It's peer review, and the criticism of firearms tool mark actually allows a dialogue and a perspective, and you can discuss both sides, and then it pushes the science forward to improve the field. And then they ask, did I ask you, and so then the defense asks, did I ask you to review material? And he says, yes, you asked me to review Ms. Melissa Oberg's conclusion to determine the basis of her opinion. And so he explains, Dr. Warren explains, that he reviewed the case file, the micro photographs, the transcript of the deposition she gave, and everything I asked for in the review Dr. Warren received. He reviewed photographs, and one aspect of the documentations he received, the lab preservation, and probably the most important thing is some of the photos that he wanted to illustrate and show were shown on the microscope. So they explained that the photo is like a 3D movie. It's a microscope that has a narrow depth of field. And switching to my other notes, forgive me, guys. I'm sorry, and I was late, or else I would have gotten this more organized, but I thought I've just got to start. So generally, they've done documentation and photography since is important, so you can show your work. This is how you can say that I know how I came to my conclusion. So photography is very important, and they say this is documentation, that photography of tool marks is vital to explain your findings. They explain subclass characteristics, There are, and this was explained actually to remind all of you when Dr. Melissa, or not doctor, it was Melissa Oberg, when she testified, she was a firearms tool mark examiner, impressive background. She also explained this, the difference between class, subclass, and individual characteristics. And so Dr. Warren is essentially going over that again. They're asking them again to reiterate the difference. And Dr. Warren is explaining it to the jury that how important class characteristics versus subclass characteristics and individual characteristics. And to remind all of you, subclass or class characteristics are more broad. You know, there are things that are all created in the same factory that have these kind of class characteristics. And then there's subclass characteristics where maybe all of these things made in the same factory at the same month sort of have maybe some unique, more unique features. There are these subclass and individual characteristics are if you own something or you own a car or a gun and it gets dinged and it has this very individual mark on it because someone hit your car in a certain way and it's unlike any other car now because it has this individual characteristic. So we're going over all of these things. And some class can't tell you one specific tool something came from, but the individual can. So he has seen that video of the 6-hour manufacturing. He didn't find it relevant because it didn't discuss specific tools. That was shown during Dr. Melissa Oberg's testimony. It only showed the slide and frame, not the extractor or the ejector. So defense asks them, have labs been shut down for only identifying subclass characteristics? And he said, yes, most recently, the Rhode Island state lab was shut down. And he mentioned something about a Wyoming state lab. And then they got into cycled rounds versus fired rounds. And I want to remind you, this was one of the biggest confusing things with Dr. Melissa Oberg's testimony is how she explained that in order to test if a certain cycled round came from a gun, she would fire a round. And there were a lot of questions about that. I want to remind everyone that I did go on Duty Ron to ask his expert, his tool mark expert, more about this. And for anyone that wants to understand this more, I recommend heading to Duty Ron's channel and watching where I was on as a guest. I think it was a week ago. It was a week ago Sunday. It was very important to this. So go watch that later. But they're getting into, okay, let's talk cycled rounds versus fired rounds and how we compare these two things. And Dr. Warren explains that in a unified cartridge, in an unfired cartridge, in a semi-automatic like firearm, it ejects the case and it auto reloads the next live round. So ejecting the live round from it leaves a mark on the brass case. And so if you fire around and it is experiencing a higher pressure, the forces from the extractor and ejector tool, you sort of have this explosive reaction. So they will leave like stronger marks on it. Like they're deeper because of the pressure, but it still is ejected. So he is aware, Dr. Warren is aware that several guns were tested and that this certain item 314, which was a 6-hour gun from Richard Allen's house, was tested with the, you know, the cartridge that was found at the crime scene. So he's aware of this. And is it appropriate to examine? Here's a question for him. Is it appropriate to examine cycled versus fired rounds? And he said, it's a process that's done. Generally, because of different pressures, generally, I would expect to see apples to apples, not apples to oranges. And this research is going back to 2010. And he explained that he said that even a 15-degree angle change would not produce the same marks and found differences in pressure could possibly cause a different looking mark. And so the next question, did Oberg use cycle test round to draw a conclusion about item 316? No, she says the marks on the cycled were on the cycled round were not prominent or they were not prominent enough and they were not there at all. And so, or they were not prominent marks. And so are you generally okay with that? They ask if they're not prominent. And he explains that in order to identify a gun, it has to be repeatable and reproducible across fired and unfired cartridge. So it has to be repeatable against both. So item 314, which is the 6-hour gun that was found at Richard Allen's home, Was that not the case? They ask him. It was never established apples to apples. And oh, he explains that it was not established apples to apples. And then they ask, are there error rate studies that compare cycled rounds to unfired rounds? Answer, no. So there were three tool marks in play when it comes to identifying Melissa Oberg's work, when it came to identifying the unspent cartridge, the cartridge at the crime scene with the 6-hour gun. There were three specific tool marks. And he received the macro and micro photographs. And he explained that with the ejector, there are possible submarks. And he explains that Oberg documented the ejector well when compared to 316. She noted a high characteristic of subclass of computer controlled, and these have the highest propensity for subclass marks. There's an extractor though that didn't have any documentation about subclass marks. And so he explained that he didn't see documentation from Melissa Oberg about subclass marks and that there was no direct examination that he could see. And they said, okay, well, what about the barrel hood? Well, the barrel hood and chamber face has even less research behind it. There's not much out there even on it. So most commonly we study the extractor and the ejector to look for potential subclass characteristics. And so was there potential for subclass for all three? Yes. Subclass marks. Yes, there was potential. Is it possible to draw conclusions on characteristics? He said, well, not unless you've identified subclass marks and individual characteristics. And Oberg did this only for the ejector. And the witness is using a large defense to demonstrate and show the jury with the photograph too. Just, you know, he has a photograph of we can't really see it, but it's clearly from like a microscope. He explained that subclass mark characteristics are larger and equally spread out. For example, mountains versus valleys. There's a light explanation. You should look between mountains and valleys for individual characteristics. And he explains other striations are the mountains and the valleys. Defense asks, was Rhode Island lab having trouble? Objection. We didn't get to know what that was about. So, CMS, it was consecutive matching the striator marks, is what is known as CMS. And he gets really into CMS. That sort of like becomes, I'm learning like, oh, this is like your specialty. Because he says that there's a body of critical experts that say examiners need to determine specific agreement. A crisis is an answer to those critiques to numerically define so you can say it's okay. There's a major objection of Luttrell at this moment. He explains, so by Luttrell, so the prosecution is like, objection, hold on, pause, let's go back. And he says, most state labs do not use CMS. Is that right? And he says, and a sidebar is called by Judge Gull during this time. They come back, he explains that CMS is recognized by by AFTI, and that there are major critiques, though, of how subjective results are by different examiners. So now we have like a lot of back and forth about CMS. I mean, and if you guys are kind of confused following this, welcome to the club as I read the notes. I was really trying to understand and pay attention and get good notes for everyone. It was difficult to follow along with this, and we were all trying to understand in the gallery. So did you apply CMS to Oberg's findings? The extractor had... Also, I want to point this out. A witness, he wouldn't answer yes or no questions directly, and it really bothered the prosecution. We'll get to that in just a minute. But they asked, did you apply CMS to Oberg's findings, like his CMS specialty? And he said it was not sufficient because the extractor had one run of four, so it was not sufficient. And The ejector, if you ignore all subclass characteristics, he wasn't able to conclude sufficient agreement. And so his conclusion would be that there is insufficient agreement. So then we all had a break at that moment. There was also an interesting time during that too, though, where I want to go back where he said, are you aware that most crime labs do not use this? So back when the prosecution's like, let's talk about this. He said, yes or no? Are you aware? Yes or no? And he just would not, he wouldn't answer. And there was a moment where things kind of got heated. He's like, just answer yes or no. And the expert witness would not answer like yes or no. He always wanted to explain something and people got really frustrated. So that was kind of a heated moment right before lunch. And then the break. There's a morning break for 15 minutes. Then there's lunch. Then there's an afternoon break. So this was morning break. We come back from morning break. And now it's cross-exam with Luttrell. And first question is he asked, and so follow along with me, guys. I'll be honest. I was, once again, trying to get all the information I could. I was trying to process it all. The tool mark examining is a really interesting thing. I'm learning a lot about it, but even I get confused sometimes. So follow along with me here and forgive me if I'm reading my notes for the first time since I wrote them today. And usually I try to go through them before we all jump on. Question, mechanical fingerprints. You learned and applied the term after the time with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Is that right? Yes. So why don't you have that, have a written report on this at all? And his answer is, Dr. Warren's answer is, well, it didn't come up. Well, aren't we talking about tool marks? Correct. And then he explains, well, studies show that the first bullet that comes out of a gun, you know, the first bullet that's, you know, can be compared to the 10,000th bullet. Is that right? In other words, it would keep the same mark from the first to 10,000th. And he said, correct. And so Luttrell says, so the 6-hour mark of two, it would stay consistent over the years. Is that right? And he said, correct. That's right. So subclass characteristics. Is subclass characteristics a new study? No, it is not. Right. So Luttrell says it's been around for 90 years. It's been studied for a very long time. Is that right? His answer, likely close to that. Dr. Warren did a very good job evading questions and being like, oh, maybe, or I don't know, or possibly, but never saying yes or no. It drove the prosecution batty. So subclass, this thing that's been studied for 90 years, subclass characteristics, breaks it down. Is that correct? Yes, he says. So what is a class characteristic example? And he explains that there's something with the relationship to the extractor, to the ejector. Things got a little confusing here for me, forgive me. But then he gets into factories and he explains that a firearm is assembled by someone. This is questions by Luttrell saying, he's like, a firearm that's assembled in a factory, it's assembled by someone and the individual doing is an individual is doing the assembling. Is that right? And it may or may not come from a different company, this person. And he said, yeah, that's correct. And he goes through all of the things. So all of these different things can happen in a factory and different people can manage this, right? Yes. And okay, so this was a moment that was interesting. They said that, so Luttrell explained, they got to a point where they explained that Melissa Oberg noted her concerns or findings in a report in that she allegedly checked everything. And Luttrell asks, did she document any concerns that she had about subclass characteristics of the extractor or injector? So after all these questions about subclass characteristics and the studies and how defined these studies are, did she document any concerns she had about subclass characteristics of the extractor or injector? And the answer was finally no, but he actually had to ask many times to get him to answer yes or no. So this was now like 3 or 4 times this had happened with the witness, and this was the most intense time. He had to ask him multiple times to get him to say No. In other words, she had no concerns about the subclass characteristics. Luttrell's next question. Would it surprise you to learn that Melissa Oberg has so much more time than you as a tool mark examiner? Zing. And he said, no, it would not surprise him. Sir, does APNI encourage its membership to continue research? He actually says no to that, which is weird. And he asks again in a different way. And then he says, yes, correct. Like, he was just kind of really, you know, he's working for the defense. He would really go out of his way to not answer directly. Are you suggesting then that she forgot about subclass characteristics during her research by claiming that she didn't document them well? And he is saying it's possible because she didn't document them. So in other words, anything's possible. What he's saying is she didn't document some subclass characteristics, document them well. And so he's saying, are you suggesting that she forgot about subclass characteristics during her research? And his answer was, I'm saying it's possible because she didn't document them. Now that sweater weather is finally here, I'm excited for timeless fall fashion. Shopping with Quince makes it easy and affordable. All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, and they have something for the whole family, making coordinating outfits for family fall photos so easy. By partnering directly with top factories and cutting out the cost of the middleman, Quince passes the savings on to us. Quince also prides themselves on using safe, ethical factories. Recently, I got my hands on a Quince cashmere sweater. It is so cozy and just that classic timeless fall style I'm drawn to. I can dress it up or down, which is perfect for traveling when I'm attending trials. Get cozy in Quince's high-quality wardrobe essentials. Go to quince.com/hiddentruecrime for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/hiddentruecrime to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/hiddentruecrime. Does anyone wish that healthy eating was just easier? Like, I don't even want to think about it, but this is why I started using meal kits from Sunbasket. The kits are delivered straight to my door with all of the ingredients and easy to follow recipes. I can choose my own meals, but I actually let Sunbasket create my family menu for me. Again, I don't even want to think about this. They know my dietary requests, carb conscious and dairy free, plus my requests for less than 20 minutes of prep time. On the menu this week, pork lettuce cups, sweet potato chili, and shepherd's pie. The meats are antibiotic-free, the produce from hand-picked farms. Sunbasket also offers pre-made meals with zero prep or mess. They make a dinner faster than takeout and much healthier. Go to sunbasket.com/hiddentruecrime today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/hiddentruecrime to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order.
88% of the workweek is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.
So everything you've ever learned is attached to this report. And Dr. Warren says, no, but every time I've had a case, I've attached it to this report of mine. And Oberg says, Oberg has determined 3 tool marks. Is that correct? Not 1, not 2, but 3. He says, that's correct. And by basing her opinion on 3 separate tool marks, does that not improve her determination of the marks? And then there's a major objection and they come back. She knows of 3 different distinct tool marks. Does that not strengthen the results that she obtained? So again, he's saying she found not just 1, not just 2, but 3 marks. Does that not strengthen her determination? And he says, No. There was some agreement on the subclass and some on the extractor, and no on the barrel. And they say, but did she not find sufficient agreement in her documenting? And he says, no, she said some below that she said there was some sufficient, but that doesn't illustrate sufficient agreement. The task of the examiner is to look and see if there are similar markings. Yes. So it's not apples to oranges, and she can test it's adequate to compare. Can't she test that it's adequate to compare? And his answer is she actually found that she could not determine the fired to the cycled, the fired round to the cycled round. She found the test fired round suitable. So pause. I've got to go over this because I feel like I'm giving wrong information here if I don't clarify what I have in my notes here. So let me read my quasi shorthand stuff. So the task of the examiner is to look and see if there are similar markings. That is correct. And then he says, but then why is this not apples to oranges? This is not apples to oranges then, prosecution says. This is apples to apples. She can absolutely test and it's adequate to compare these two things because the study is done so long. And so Dr. Warren is trying to claim, well, no, she found that she could not determine the fire to the cycle. And then the prosecution is saying, but she said she found the test fired round suitable. And then he says, yes, that was her conclusion. Correct. Okay. So I'm glad I reread it. I understand it more now. Forgive me for sometimes I just have to do it twice to like, let's make sure we have this right. So again, he's trying to say it's not apples to oranges. The prosecution's trying to say this is not apples to oranges. This is apples to apples. Like, come on. And Dr. Warren is trying to say, well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. Fired round to cycled round. They are essentially agreeing to disagree there. And then he does admit that she found the test fired round suitable in her conclusion. And that's where they can both agree. Luttrell asks Dr. Warren, did you document for the jury that you could use ejector marks and it was suitable to compare? And he said, no, he didn't document that. And then they asked, well, do you actively use CMS? And he said, yes, in 2021, October. He goes, yeah, I do actively use CMS. And then Luttrell tries to say, really? Well, because in October of 2021, you testified that you did not use CMS. So what's that about? And he said, well, that's only applicable to strident marks. And so I was probably testifying about a case where I didn't use CMS because he was all about CMS at first. Remember, like CMS is like the bomb.com. And so now he's like, well, it depends. It's not applicable unless it's to strident marks. And so then there's a question, you know, you received training in 2022 or 2023 with CMS training. So this is like a pretty new thing for you. He says, well, that was just my most recent training. And then Luttrell asks him, like, well, could you go into court and testify in CMS with another examiner's photos? And he said, yes, that occurs regularly. Well, did you indicate that you did not use CMS technology when it comes to this? Like, when it comes to this, like, you're all about CMS, but you didn't even use that here? And he goes, well, there's some... It was his answers did not make it easy for me to record his answers. He was always kind of just, he would sort of avoid the answer. So I can't even tell you what his answer really was to that. The next question by Luttrell is, have you testified in court? Haven't you testified in court and have said that you cannot ever offer a conclusion just based on photos alone on another examiner's photos? So he, according to Luttrell, has testified in court before that he cannot offer a conclusion based on another examiner's photographs alone. And his answer is, I'm sure I have at a time said something like that. Yes. And so Luttrell says, are those your words that you cannot come to a conclusion with photographs alone? And then his answer is, well, in that particular case, yes. And then Luttrell said, but you said it as in a general rule that you cannot look at photos of another examiner and make any conclusions. Then Luttrell asks if he is accredited. Luttrell says, so you own your own lab? Yes. So are you affiliated with all of these, with the tool mark examiners? And he says he's not accredited. He says he's not accredited, and what he has to do in order to become accredited is pay a peer to look at his procedures. five different cases that he's done and accurately reflect, and they have to accurately reflect what the policies say about toolmark examining. And so then Luttrell asks them, so you don't have a confidence in accreditation? Like, why aren't you accredited? And his answer is, that would be fair. Yeah, he doesn't have confidence in accreditation. And then Luttrell asks him, what is the most important tool in a firearm tool examiner's pocket? This was an interesting answer. Ready for this? What is the most important tool, Dr. Warren, in a firearm tool examiner's pocket? And he goes, well, that would be myself. And so Luttrell said, well, how valuable is your microscope? And he said, it's valuable at times. And he said, well, how crucial is it? And his answer is, well, if you're going to do a comparison, then you need it. You need the microscope to compare the different cartridge to the, for the tool marks, to the, you know, the gun. And it's called a comparison microscope. And so then Luttrell asks, well, why is your comparison microscope so important to tool mark examination? And his answer is, well, when you do use it and you need it to compare, it's important. Like, that's his answer. I'm like, that's okay. So Luttrell keeps pushing. So you can use that tool, or can you use another tool? And his answer is, well, no, I could use another tool like a 3D microscope, but not a comparison microscope. And so then Luttrell moves on. Were you trained on Gaffney? And he says, well, he was trained another way, but it was based off of Gaffney. Don't, whatever that is. And so then he goes back. So Luttrell goes back. So can you take or leave a comparison microscope? You don't need it. And he says, yeah, I don't need it. And then Luttrell says, let the evidence speak for itself. You use that term often. He says, yes, I've, and then, he, and then Luttrell said, and you firmly believe in documenting evidence to the best of your ability. He says, yes. And you offer services for consulting. Yes, I have a website email for people to call. And so Luttrell says, so if by Mr., according to Mr. Rosie, you're asked here, if you have anything, so the prosecution, Luttrell says, so if by Mr. Rosie asking, if you have everything that you need to determine some conclusions on Ms. Oberg's reports, you didn't ask for any additional evidence to make a conclusion. And his answer is that he didn't receive any other evidence. And so Luttrell says, well, did you ask attorneys for additional items, like more items like the cartridge or other items to compare? Like, did you ask him for the actual items and evidence? And he says, I can't recall. And Luttrell says, well, if you were asked to compare the different items, would you use your comparison microscope for these different items and evidence? He says, yes, I would. And so Luttrell says, if you're looking at this image under your microscope, under your personal microscope, wouldn't it change? Wouldn't the picture be different? Because he has this big picture up, you know, of Melissa Oberg's microscope. And he said, no, it wouldn't change. So the photo would not look any different if you put it under a microscope. There wouldn't be any lighting difference or anything. He goes, that's correct. Oh, he goes, it would not look any different at all because of certain lighting or anything. And he goes, oh, well, that's correct. It could look different. He goes, it could look different. And so his implying, why didn't you do your own analysis then on the tool marks? So redirect with Rosie, he gets up and he says, you started working with the defense for more than a year, correct? Did I request you to make any additional reports on evidence? And Dr. Warren says, no, I do not recall you asking me to do that. In other words, he did what he was asked to do, and that's why he did it. And then we have jury questions. There were so many jury questions, so many. Question one is, how would CMS be used? I love this question by the jury, by the way, because one of his big talking points was this new thing that people need to use CMS. It's so important in tool marks, but then he never explained how he used it. So the jury asks, how would CMS be used? And they say that it would be applied the same way, but it would meet CMS threshold. So in other words, he would essentially apply it the exact same way that Melissa Oberg does her work, but it would meet CMS threshold, not like the other way. Next question. Does removing and cleaning your gun change gun marks? He says it would not change individual characteristics. Does the manufacturer keep track of subclass characteristics? Answer, no. Is there a reason that you did not do your own report? And his answer is, it was just requested of me to go over the documents of Melissa Oberg's and educate the attorney and explain the conclusion. Next question by the jury. Would doing your own analysis be more conclusive? He wrote, potentially I could agree or disagree with her analysis. It could be changed by examination. Are you certified as a tool mark examiner? Yes, he is certified. Did you look at the subclass characteristics of the cartridge? Did you look at subclass characteristics of the cartridge? And his answer, I didn't really get it. The possible for the cartridge to have subclass characteristics. And then Luttrell jumps in and he goes, well, did you look under a microscope under this cartridge for subclass characteristics? And he did not. And next question, what is the relevance of the cartridge having similar subclass characteristics? And he explains that you're funneling the potential firearms that match. And so it's really important, so you have to funnel them. So you have to see which ones have similar marks, which ones have different marks. You have to funnel them through until you get to something more specific. Are you aware? The next question by the jury, I thought this was interesting by the jury. Are you aware that Ms. Oberg's findings have been verified by a second party? He says, yes. I was like, wow, juror. The next question, have you read Oberg's deposition? Yes. She testified that she had all her examinations and all conclusions were verified by a verifier. And his answer is, I don't recall that's what she said. Next question. Were you here when Ms. Oberg testified? She was not there. Are you aware the extraction mark matches? His answer is, generally, that is the way it works. The question, though, is the lack of documentation. So there you go. And then we had lunch. And lunch. Exactly. The witness is there to confuse the jury and bring unreasonable doubt. I was really impressed by the jurors' questions on that one. Because like I said, it's been a hard one for me to follow very clearly. And it seems like they have a really good grasp on it. And they had some really interesting questions. After lunch, it was cell expert Stacy Eldridge. And it's nearly 2 p.m. at this time. And she has a bachelor's in science in computer information management. And she has a master's degree in computer info. She worked at the FBI as a forensic examiner, was chief examiner at one point, specifically for phones, tablets, iPads, etc. She was with the FBI for 10 years. She was a part of the computer evidence response team that preserves and examines digital evidence. And what she did there is, laptops, smart cell phones, smart watches, et cetera. And she also trained the new FBI examiners. And she was the senior forensic examiner and instructor at the FBI when she left after 10 years. She's also a private detective in Nebraska. And now she consults as an expert witness for the court and is an adjunct professor at two different universities. She has testified for both government and defense. And she owns Silicon Prairie Services, LLC. She works with local law enforcement and as a special agent in FBI to examine digital data. She usually charges $400 an hour. But for this case, she tells us that she is charging $300 an hour. She's worked 65 hours doing examinations and 15 hours in prep for testimony. She reviewed Libby's iPhone, and as she reviewed it, she reviewed the Libby's iPhone, and she reviewed it after it was examined in October 2017 by Brian Bunner. with the Indiana State Police. And so as you guys, just to like refresh your memory, Brian Bunner reviewed it using Cellbrite reports and written reports. So she's explaining everything she used to look at of Brian Bunner's, to look at everything. And she reviewed Brian Bunner's reports from October 2017. She reviewed the Cellbrite reports, the written reports, Chris Cecil's reports, everyone's reports. She also reviewed Cecil's depositions. So she has done a lot of review, in other words. And she, what she does is she gets under the hood, she explains. And under the hood means the iOS. The iOS is sort of like going under the hood of the car. I actually appreciate how she explained this. It's the operating system. And she gets under the hood of the car, or under the hood of the phone, using forensic software. And they ask her what forensic software has been used in this case. So many, she explains, I can't even name all of the main ones, but Cellbrite, Axiom, iLeaf, and others. She primarily uses Axiom for the bulk of analysis, and she also uses DB Browser and Forensic Browser, which is forensic examining software, and she uses CB to review previous reports. She extracts data, she copies the data that she's extracted, and then she analyzes it. And she also says that she doesn't ever get on like a phone immediately, because it starts changing things on the phone. And you know what? Bunner testified to this as well, that like the moment you start jumping on a phone and extracting stuff, you start to lose data every time. So you have to be careful, like don't jump on a phone right away. And so she says, she doesn't. She doesn't extract it right away. She's very careful about how to jump on. She explains that there are three different extractions that are really important to understand from Cellbrite. And these extractions are commonly used by law enforcement. The first one is the full file system. The full file system is what they want to analyze. That's like the head honcho. Like if you're law enforcement and you're assessing a case, the full file system is just as it sounds, the full file system. The middle one is the advanced slash logical. And then the bottom one is the logical. And she refers to that as like the bare bones extraction. And the best practice is to get a full file system first. Even if it takes 1, 2, 3, or 4 times to do, you just need to document it all. And again, you want to do it sooner than later because the phone data changes. So on 2/15, so February 15th, 2017, that would be the day after the bodies were found, after the day after the phone was found, Brian Bunner performed logical extraction. He could have gotten, she claims, the full file. Yes, he could have, but he only got the logical off of Libby's phone. And the only exception would be if you couldn't get the full file system. This is interesting. The only reason you wouldn't maybe be able to get a full file system is if there was an iTunes backup that was encrypted. That's like a thing. But other than that, if that wasn't a thing on Libby's phone, there's no reason you couldn't have gotten the full file system. And so when she received the full file system extraction, it was 6 months had actually passed from the first one. And it was October 2017 was when law enforcement got it. And so, of course, some data was lost. And specifically a file called the current power log. That one only lasts for one cycle after you turn the phone off and on. So like that one specifically was lost, the current power log. And you also won't have any information on the current power log if the phone is in airplane mode, but that wasn't the situation. And so she had some data from October 2017, but she did not have that info from the... hey, everyone. Sorry, I'm just trying to decide if I should jump on my phone again. Delphi Wi-Fi. It's an adventure. Yep, I'm buffering. All right. So one of the reasons... So I'll go back to where we were before the buffering issues. Okay, so there was some data that had been lost, specifically the current power log, and so she didn't have any info from the power cycle before that time, and she did want to check the Apple Health data and why the 4:43 a.m. text messages happened. So let me remind all of you, because this has been a big deal always with the defense, that they have explained that Libby's phone, that it was somehow was not connected to a tower for a time, and that all of these texts came into Libby's phone at 4:43 a.m. And there was a possibility, was the phone turned off? Like, what happened during this time? Did somebody do something to her phone? Where the prosecution has kind of implied that after a certain time, her phone stopped moving. It was discovered under Abby's body. So here we go. And that's, so she is saying, being hired by the defense, that she really wants to check the Apple Health data and why the 4:43 a.m. messages came in at that time and what happened. So she downloaded the Knowledge C database. We've also heard of the Knowledge C database before too. The prosecution's cell experts testified to that. It tracks pretty much everything. It tracks what you are doing. It records when your screen goes on and off, when it turns off, when it turns on. It actually records your app usage activity, timestamps for everything. It's like, it has, hence the knowledge, not Knowledge C database.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So she examined Cecil's timeline and reviewed his 8/18/24 report. So his August 18th, 2024 report. And in that report, she does not agree that there were messages or FaceTime or apps or voicemails or calls coming in during that time, which is what Cecil's original report says. And this is also interesting because during Cecil's testimony, during prosecution, the defense brought this up and now they're bringing it up again. And this is their expert. So now we're going to understand what they're saying. So the prosecution claimed, well, even if text messages didn't come in, FaceTime calls and other things came in, but here we go. It doesn't mean, she says, she disagrees that that FaceTime messages or voicemails came in at that time during the course of the afternoon. There were times that Libby's phone was not connected to the tower, and the last time it connected to the cell tower was at 5:45 p.m. And then it next did not connect until 4:43 a.m. And that was on February 14th, 2017. So again, let me reiterate that. The last time it connected to the cell tower was February 13th at 5:43. And then the next time it connected was 4:43 a.m. on February 14th. So what happened between that time? Well, she reviewed the AT&T cell logs and ping information. It's the historical precision location information. It's the data that's the same basic format as where she learned the information at the FBI. And the AT&T actually does a log of the historical precision location info. And it says the date and time and the approximate location, longitude and latitude of when Libby's phone was last connected. The data between 5:44 p.m. and 4:43 a.m. showed no data between this time frame. So here's a question then from the defense. Cecil's timeline, Christopher Cecil, shows messages coming in during that time. So why then does she disagree with this part of the report? And she explains that it's because iMessage when iMessage, it's not sending as a text message. If you send an iMessage, Apple records the iMessage as the time the user sent the message, not the time it was delivered. So in other words, it looks like the time came in when the user sent it, but it did not come in, according to Stacy, until that 4:43 a.m. time. So that's why she disagrees that there were other things coming in. It makes sense to me. So she explains then that there are three data points that show the phone was not connected at all during this time. The location, the phone log, which was off, it showed it was off, and the data usage. If the phone was under Abby's body between 5:44 p.m. and 4:43 a.m., do you have info on why the phone didn't connect to the cell tower? The answer is that they could find no evidence of why. Or her answer, Stacy's answer is, it's interesting, she could find no evidence of why. I can only conclude something external. I wanted to say that's really interesting because that's also what what law enforcement said too when they were testifying for the prosecution. They could find no evidence as to why. Nobody can figure out why. She says she can only conclude that it's something external, not internal in the phone. Maybe, so now there's a question from defense. Well, maybe something was blocking the signal. Yeah, maybe, she says. Maybe something metal. Yeah, maybe something metal. Sorry, one second. Yeah, maybe something metal. Then we get into the Apple Health data. There is research from the Netherlands right now from Apple Health data that has shown that steps are the most accurate. So like when we take our steps, right, steps are the most accurate in recording our motion and what we're doing. A distance can be off, though, by 30 to 40%. I knew it. Don't tell me that, though. Sometimes I'm like, I did not go that many steps. I want to think it's accurate. More movement or exercise can make vigorous movement or things look like bouncing up and down may register more or less movement. So in other words, it's not accurate. She saw the same information on the steps and on data on Libby's phone. So how can the phone move and not be recorded in the health data? And she explains, well, health data does not recognize when you're in a car. So that's a way that a phone could move and not be recorded in health data. So remember, the prosecution has always said the phone did, or the witnesses for the prosecution have said the phone did not move. And she's saying, well, technically a phone could move and not be recorded in health data if, for example, you're in a car. The iPhone 6S does not record steps or movements when a phone is off as well. So the phone was powered off when it was found, but she was still missing. While the phone was powered off when it was found, she was still missing that log. There were no data logs to suggest the phone was on during that period, the time frame that we keep referring to. The last audio output at 5:21 p.m. was recorded on Libby's phone, and Cecil wrote in his report that the audio output was unknown and the research was incomplete. Now, the research in 2024 now is complete. And today it gives some known numeric values. For example, number one means headphones. So this gets interesting. At 2:13:17, at 10:32 p.m., a record was created. And it first started happening at 5:44 p.m. So on February 13th, 2017, at 10:32 p.m., a record was created. And this first started happening at 5:44 p.m. on February 13th. And this record shows that there were wired headphones. This was also shown in another location in the Knowledge C report where it was hard to see, but it actually literally says, quotes, wired headphones. So then the defense asks, so when it says that the audio output starts at 5:45 p.m. on February 13th, what does that mean? And Stacy's answer is, so it means that somebody inserted the headphone jack into the hole or the auxiliary of the phone. And that happened at 10:32 p.m. on February 13th, the defense asks. And she states, it definitely says that something was inserted. Question, can you think of any explanation of this that does not involve human interaction? She says, I cannot come up with any explanation. Question, the auxiliary cord headphones, when you plug it in, by doing that, would you stop sound from coming out of a phone? And her answer is, milliseconds before the cable was inserted, there was a call coming in. That's chilling to me. Milliseconds before the cable was inserted, there was a call coming in. So now we do cross-exam with the it's McClelland. So prosecution, McClelland is up and he first goes off to her education, her training, her background, kind of drills her, asks her when it all was. And then he asks Stacey, when you talk about testifying four times before, did that deal with computers? And she says, yes. And there was one time in 2011 and that was a cell phone, but you don't have a case number for that. And she says, yes. So then McClelland asks, is this the first time that you've testified about cell phone analysis or Knowledge C database? And she says, well, I did in July, but not before that. Well, did you get any other information from the case to review, like facts involved in this case, for example, where the bodies were found or how the phone was found under the body? And she said, no, I just have this. And did you go to the location of the crime scene? McClelland asks her. No. Do you agree with the timestamp and the GPS location of the Snapchat video? Her answer is yes. So question, you reviewed the Apple Health data and did you agree with it? She says, I agreed with the numbers he's extracted, but not any opinion he's testified to because I don't know what he said in his testimony. Question then, okay, so in Apple Health data, it showed that it was last recorded at 2:32 p.m. Is that right? Yes. So, and you agree that the phone did not move then between 2:32 p.m. Until it was found? And she said, what I agree with is that the phone didn't log movement. She can't agree that it didn't move. She just can only agree that it didn't log any movement. So then McClelland asked, well, before 5:44, was it in service? Answer, it was in and out of service. So question, so if a phone can go in and out of service, can it go in and out of service if you are stationary? She says, yes. Okay. Well, is it reasonable for the jury to believe that between 2:32 and 5:44 p.m. that the phone received calls, texts, and then it went out of service? She says, yes. Question then at 4:43 a.m., it received a lot of calls and texts. Could it be an explanation that the phone bounced in and out of service? Yes. Well, it seems to me to put in headphones that you would have to move the phone. So wouldn't that record the data or the data? It could, she says. Yes, it could. McClelland then asked, so you said there could be a signal blocker. She said, yeah, there could be. Metal from a building? Yeah, metal from a building. But that would require movement, wouldn't it? She says, yes, it would. Well, then McClelland asked, so it seems most likely that the phone was just going in and out of service. answer to that is that she cannot give an expert opinion on that. Well, let me ask this again in another way, McLuhan says. Could this be a likely explanation? If the phone turned off at 4:43 a.m., would it log movement data? Answer, no. Okay, so now we have jury questions and it gets interesting. Question, did you write your own report of the timeline? No. Would an iPad have its own knowledge C database? Yes. Would water or moisture affect movement? No. So then, after that, McLuhan jumps in. What would water affect the port or plug-in for the phone? McLuhan asks. She states, I have no knowledge that it would log. McLuhan says, you don't know? And she says, well, it would make something non-functional, but it would not record info on its own. Next jury questions. Can you tell from data if the phone was on loud or silent vibration? She did not look at that. If you know, could there be a phone scrambler plugged in? I actually researched that, but I could not find that information. Question, could you use a historical precision location? The question is, could you use a historical precision location info on the movement, a Google Pixel using, could you use, I got it now, guys. Could you use the historical precision information on using the Ting for Richard Allen's movement on his phone, on his Google Pixel Ting phone for self-service? And her answer is yes, if they have that data. And do you have to have a phone to look at that? And her answer is no. So that they don't even need a phone to look at the historic precision location of Richard Allen's movement that day. Are there any other apps that record movement? She says, yes, one of them is WhatsApp. Did you look at any other apps? She says, no. So before we move on to some really interesting testimony, Judge Gold says, reminds everyone that she said no talking in the gallery, that you will be removed from the courtroom if you are talking, and the courtroom security will come tap you on the shoulder and you will be removed from the proceedings. I will say during the afternoon, it was a very full courtroom. they had some chairs in the back. There were people that were there. So I think it was a little bit noisier. So then the next witness is Christopher Cecil. Was also a prosecution's witness, again, phone data expert. And now OJ is going to question him now for the defense. So he is back on the stand. He is a first sergeant with the Indiana State Police. Again, he's already testified, and she just wants to talk about his report that we've already heard about. So OJ asks, there is a log on your report about audio output. What is that? And he says, I don't know. Her next question, are you able to tell us why a cell phone would not connect to a tower? He says, I don't have that education. And now we have cross-exam by McLuhan. So that was it for the defense. Cross-exam by McLuhan. He questions, you researched about headphone log? Yes, he says. Well, there was a jury question about water, right? Yes, he said there was a jury question about water. And were you able to look up on Google why that is during the break? And he says, yes. And you found that water or dirt can impact something, and it's really kind of hard to hear at this moment. But in other words, they're saying, so you found water or dirt can impact something. So now there's redirect by OJ. And so she says, this is a pretty good moment in court. She goes, what Google sites did you visit? And his answer, Google sites. Well, any credible sites? Yes, a bunch of sites. He mentions like Apple, some sites and some other maybe chat sites. And then she says, well, do you normally do your research by looking stuff up on Google? She says, no. He says no. Question by OJ. So you usually research using peer-reviewed things, right? And he says, yes. So are there things on the internet that aren't reliable? Yes. And they aren't accurate? Yes. And they are false? Yes. Was there proof of water damage on Libby's phone? No, we didn't check. And you've had this phone. It's been with law enforcement custody this whole time, correct? Yes. And law enforcement could have checked for water damage? Yes. And did law enforcement check for dirt and water damage? He says, I don't know. Christopher Cecil says, I don't know. And you and the Indiana State Police have had 7.5 years to do this. And you're coming here after a Google search? Christopher Cecil, yes. No further questions. Hold on one sec. And then they have one more witness for the day, and it's Brian Bunner. And again, that's the other cell phone data expert that has testified for the state, and now the defense has him up. Ajay says, do you know what audio output start is? He says, no. Next question. Did you do any Google searches on the break? No. There is no cross and there are no jury questions. And that was the end of the day.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.